Thank you, sir. May I have another?
Yeah, yeah, oh yeah. What condition my condition was in?
I woke up this morning with the sundown shining in.
Where's the money, Lebowski? Where's the f***ing money, head?
It's down there somewhere. Let me take another look.
I found my mind in a brown paper bag, but then...
106 miles to Chicago. We got a full tank of gas, half a pack of cigarettes. It's dark, and we're wearing sunglasses.
Hit it.
I tripped on a cloud and fell 8 miles high. I tore my mind on a jagged sky.
Okay, you know, you guys aren't privy to all the new... That's what you pay me for.
I just dropped in to see what condition my condition was in.
Illinois Nazis. I hate Illinois Nazis.
Now let's cut through the chase, okay? What are you guys selling?
I lost you $60,000. There is no one who wants to make that money back for you more than I do.
There's just one thing, dude.
What's that?
You have to use so many cuss words.
What the f*** you talking about?
Don't worry, nobody's listening anyway.
I woke up this morning with the sundown.
Hello and welcome back to Stacks and Jacks. I'm coming out with Greg Pappas on the board. And commenting on futures and other stuff. SP futures down 28. NASDAQ futures down 131. And the question is, what did Lou do to this rally? We were up a bunch yesterday after the Fed announcement and double talk. News conference. And, we're up again last night, and everything was cool, and then all of a sudden it started to slush and snow rain here, and the market tanked. So what do you have to say about that, Greg?
Par for the course.
Ah.
Got a little bit of up, a little bit of down.
We have Professor Lou.
Buy the dips and sell the rips.
Yeah.
My magic investment touch strikes again.
I was thinking about you this morning, Lou. They had some guy on, don't take this personally, from Boys Town, and he's a tattoo artist. I said, I got to tell Lou this.
Evidently, no, wait a minute. Okay, so just so I'm clear, we're not talking about the Boys Town of the old movie. We're talking about the district in Chicago?
Yes.
Okay.
No, Spencer Tracy is not the dude.
No, okay, got it.
Evidently, there's a new wave rushing across the tattoo industry that they are now putting people under for their tattoos. Me never getting a tattoo. I don't know anything about this. And now this guy is all against it, saying the pain is part of getting the tattoo. You don't want to be out. Plus, he wouldn't trust any of the anesthesiologists.
The average tattoo parlor.
Yeah.
here.
Yeah, it's like
inhale this.
But the guy says it's part of the tattoo. The pain it won't last forever, and it's part of getting the tattoo. And I'm like,
yeah,
okay,
that strikes me as. You know, the sort of bad idea, unless we've got a surfeit of qualified anesthesiologists that are running around looking for employment.
I don't think that's the case.
I went through a procedure to take some skin off my face, you know, the pre-cancer kind of thing.
Well, a lot of that going on.
And so while they were looking at this, they said, well, you've got a fairly large patch of, you know, skin area that we would treat with this laser. And I said, okay, well, is it going to cost any more to just, you know, sort of resurface my whole face? And they said, no, just take that layer of skin off. And I said, is it going to hurt much? And they said, well, yeah, I mean, you'll feel some pain, but we put a numbing cream on your face. I'm just going to provide you and listeners with some health advice. If you are offered this procedure, don't. it hurt like hell.
Well, your face has a gazillion nerve endings.
Well, yeah. So basically what it is they're running a pulsing laser over your face. And I knew I was going to look bad after, you know, a day or so after it was over. I looked like the guy in Phantom of the Opera after they took the mask off. And then you're treated for the next, you know, 6 days or so of looking down at your clothes and seeing what looks like dandruff all over you. And that's the skin falling off, the skin face, particles falling off your face.
Well, didn't they used to actually peel the top layer off, which was like worse?
A skin peel is usually done with chemicals, and it has the same kind of effect. I don't know if it's as painful. This was unreal, and I'm not. I will just tell you that if you want to get tortured, have somebody put one of those facial lasers in one of your nostrils and run that.
Well,
that
it wasn't painful for them.
Well, that's right. It wasn't painful for them, and then then to pay for the privilege, and my wife told me that when I was trying to describe what it was like, she said, "Well, that's what it feels like to have a tattoo removed." And I said, "I thought tattoos were painful." She said, "Tattoos can hurt depending on where they're done, but it's not nearly as painful as getting it removed."
When you get it removed, is it actually look okay or not?
I mean, there's a small scar. The techniques may have gotten better since she had hers removed, but there's definitely a small scar there.
We had a lady who worked here who went out and got one of Jesus Christ, and it was at least 2/3 of the size of her back.
Yep.
How the hell would you ever get that removed?
In small increments.
Wow.
Over the course of many months. And I mean, this is just another marker of why you tell your kids, don't do anything that you can't immediately reverse, at least for a while.
For a while.
You know, because one of my children, when he was, he must have been right after he turned 18. He turned 18 while he was still in high school. Went and got a tattoo of one of the creatures. Are you familiar with the book, Maurice Sendak's book, Where the Wild Things Are?
I've heard of it. I haven't read it.
Okay. Greg, pull up the images from Where the Wild Things Are. It's a children's book. He loved it. He had one of those creatures, a small one, tattooed onto his shoulder, on his back, which is just perfect for him. I mean, he's kind of a whimsical kid anyway. He's not a kid anymore by now, obviously. And he showed it to me, and I thought, okay, well, I mean, at some point you may regret that. He goes, well, I don't think so. So he entered basic training a year later. And, part of the deal in those things is you have what are called shower formations, where everybody grabs their towel and their soap, and you're marched down to the showers. You move through, depending on how it's done, you go like into a hot, cold, hot, cold, hot, cold shower for like 5 seconds, and you work through the showers in the shower stall, and then you're out. Well, of course, his training instructors see the tattoo of this thing on his shoulder, and they immediately know what it is. It's from Where the Wild Things Are. So he became, get a load of wild thing, and that became the focus of more than a little derision and a lot of attention from the drill instructors.
Oh, hey, I have a question for my buddy whose son is now graduating Air Force Academy. His pilot training is going to be in Columbus, Georgia.
Columbus, Mississippi.
Is that a good spot?
The fact that he's going to pilot training is great. Columbus is, it's a good spot for two reasons. The spots that everybody used to want to get were around the Phoenix area, or in the Southwest, because the weather was good and you're in the Southwest and there's lots to do and da da da. But the guys that I knew who went through Columbus and some of the other pilot training bases in the Southeast actually had a better experience because they had more terrible weather that they had to fly through and fly around. They got used to dodging thunderstorms and bad visibility, all the things associated with the Southeast in terms of weather. And learning to do that when you're training is a real advantage. If the first time, I had friends of mine who trained at at Williams outside of Phoenix, and you know their comment was, the first time I saw a thunderstorm or had to fly through a thunderstorm was when I was in upgrade training. I'd never seen it when I was a student at Williams.
You fly through a thunderstorm, or you fly around it?
Well, you know, sometimes you got to fly like close to it. And when you're in T-38s, I don't know exactly what the tracks are now, but when you get into T-38s, which are supersonic and can go, you know, pretty high, you'll dodge them, you'll go around them, you'll go through the tops of them. But just the advantage of being in a lot of weather when you're learning to fly is significant.
You said they're not as big on the glider training now that you were talking about, and as of now, there's no delineation, like in his personality, whether he's going to be flying the tanker or flying the fighter jets. Right now, they're just going to fighter school.
Yeah, they're going through the basic program. Yeah, they'll track him. They'll track him at some point, but good for him. That's fantastic.
Yeah, I'm pretty proud of him. He should be.
He had
two pretty good summers. One, he was in, I think, Scotland, and the other one, I think, he was in the Philippines or someplace.
So this goes to something that we've talked about, but you know, one of the things that when I was there, we did have these kinds of exchange programs. We had exchange cadets from France, from Germany. Three of my classmates who were French speakers spent a year at L'École d'État, the French Air Force Academy in Paris. We had, as I said, we had German, English cadets who were, spending a year with us, but that program has gotten much more developed. And notwithstanding the comments from the commander in chief about NATO and Europe standing on its own and everything else, we intend to fight if we have to fight. We intend to fight with allies, and this is especially true in the Pacific, and. The interaction between these countries and the United States military is significant, and it's getting even more developed because looking at what, for example, China's doing, and looking for what Russia's doing with respect to aircraft, for example, the only fifth generation fighter that's sitting out there on, as far as I'm concerned, the side of the good guys is the F-35, and if you Canada was making noises about saying, well, you know, we might cancel the F-35 because of the president's language, referring to Canada as a 51st state, you know, we might cancel the F-35 and go buy a Saab product, like the Gripen, beautiful little fighter, very nice, but as somebody pointed out to them, you will be, so you're flying F-18s now, so you're probably 30 years behind in terms of the technology that these aircraft can manage. So if you buy the Gripen, now you're going to be 60 years behind by the time you get things turned around. So it was a long-winded way of saying countries are buying our primary weapon systems for their defense. They rely on us for that. They rely on us for the targeting and the upgrade packages and things like that.
But the man's telling them that Griffin better get their act together and have a better one.
Well, that's.
I don't agree with that, but
it takes a long time to do that. And as technologically competent as Sweden is, it's going to take them a while to put out a stealth fighter. But. Anyway, my point is, this kind of integration continues regardless of whatever is happening.
Well, the F-22, that thing's dead and buried.
I'm sorry.
The F-22. Is dead and buried. That was better than the 35, right?
It's a much better dogfighter than the 35. But the 22, I think, in my opinion, remains the best fighter in the world. And it's especially with some of the upgrades, but you got to remember that the F-35 is not designed to be a dogfighter. It is.
Well, is this one of those deals that if they just would have stuck with the F-22 and watched the cost go down. Did they save anything by starting a whole new plane? I guess my question.
No, and you know, it's a very expensive aircraft, and Gates, you know, Robert, I when Gates canceled the production at about 180 airplanes, I you know, sort of threw my hands up and said, what the heck are we doing? Because that's a very competent, capable fighter, and it's going to remain that way for a while.
How do you keep parts going if you only got 100 planes?
They kept the production line open for parts. They're cannibalizing some of them. A number, like three or four of them, got damaged down at Tyndall, I think, in the Florida Panhandle when that hurricane came ashore, and they couldn't get them out of there, so they had them in hangars, and the hangars got destroyed, and the planes inside were badly damaged. So those planes can be cannibalized for parts, you know. But they're gradually, both the numbers on that aircraft are gradually going to reduce.
Hey, Chief, when you say did they save anything? You know, the F-35 is the most expensive thing in history, right? So $2 trillion or something.
Yeah, that's what I'm getting to. But the 22 is supposed to be cheaper.
The unit costs are going
way down, and because of the overseas sales, so that the cost on the 35 is going to be comparable to the 22 by the time the program is over, and I will tell you, just in terms of strategy, they're already flying sort of quasi replacement aircraft for the 35 now that are unmanned. And they will, you know, the Loyal Wingman program or whatever they call it, which is basically an unmanned aircraft with robust AI that flies alongside the 35 and can stay with it, in some cases refuel it, but that'll stay with it in combat and in missions. And you know, the idea is that we'll have a number of these things along with the F-35 as you know, smart aircraft to help maintain superiority.
The F-22, it says, is when they stopped production, it was like 300 and some million a jet, and the F-35 right now is about like 115.
Yeah, and the F-35, if we complete the full buy, the F-35 eventually, I think, drops to somewhere in the 70 million an aircraft number. Maybe a little bit lower with the...
exercises, say with South Korea or Japan or somebody or other, what percentage, other than, you know, having a bunch of ships and planes running around to intimidate people or whatever you do, how much of that is really people working their tail off to make sure the communications between the various groups happen? You know, because, I mean, it's like, you know, when the guy showed up in Ohio for the, to shoot at Trump or whatever the hell happened there, you know.
Yeah, they were all in different radios.
All different radios. I mean, is a lot of what these things do when people get together is to make sure we can at least talk to each other?
Absolutely. Yeah, and coordination and the use of the same call signs and same radio procedures. More and more of this is getting automated, but in terms of supporting, for example, ground troops, it's crucial that our pilots be able to talk to, you know, South Korean forces on the ground, and they understand each other, and it's crucial for their people on the ground to be able to direct our pilots, and so. There's a whole, and this is something that popped up in the initial stages of the Ukraine war, and to a certain extent is still there. It takes a tremendous amount of coordination to deconflict air battles and air operations in terms of integrating your flight paths and weapons delivery routes with even basic stuff like artillery, you know, which fires up through the airspace that you're flying in.
That must be cool, dodging that.
That's one of the reasons why they said it takes a lot of coordination and practice. And this was something that we found that the Russians simply could not do. And as far as I know, they still haven't been able to put it together. You know, they could fly aircraft in 3-4 aircraft strike packages, but you know, it became apparent that they couldn't mass aircraft to come in and attack, you know, Kiev simultaneously. And part of the reason for that was they hadn't practiced this stuff. We practice it all the time.
What is the when you go to one of these things, like when you go with you know, how many ships you send to see with South Korea, that's got to be a pretty expensive exercise, I would think. You know, getting everybody over there and all that stuff. I mean, where do those ships come from? Are they all in Hawaii? Are they all over there?
They stage them. They stage them out of bases in the United States. We used to run an operation every year called Reforger, which was a massive troop movement practice, you know, exercise in Europe, where we would transport, you know, two or three divisions just for practice and coordination. We would, you know, load up all their stuff in the U.S. and then move it to Europe to practice how we did that in wartime. It's one of the reasons why the deployment into Iraq in the Gulf War I went as smoothly as it did, because we had practiced that for Europe for decades.
How long does it take to hop in a destroyer in San Diego and make it over to South Korea for an exercise? My God.
Takes a while. You know, the planning for it goes on. You know, the planning for that kind of stuff never stops.
Have to pre-position all kinds of fuel and stuff in Hawaii so the fuel truck guys can fill up and all that stuff?
Yeah, in some cases, yeah. You pre-position fuel, you practice refueling at sea. You practice going into fueling stations at Guam and other places. You plot out evasive courses. You, on the way there, you practice anti-submarine warfare and coordination with your other vessels. You drill on air defense. You practice, you know, your own aircraft fly air attack missions against their own ships to get them up to speed. And then when you get there, you start the integration process with the allies, with the Japanese, with the Koreans, with the Filipinos, whoever's.
So the Air Force heads for like the Air Force bases in coordination with the Navy, in coordination with submarines that are making sure there's nobody in the way. I mean, I can't imagine the logistics of that.
Well,
it's got to be like a World War II thing. I mean,
and that's why, you know, the great line is, you know, unfamiliar people think that you know, battle tactics and battle strategy wins wars, but you know, the people who know war know that logistics wins wars, and that's the truth, and that's the reason we won World War II. That's the reason the North beat the South in the Civil War. It the ability of our management systems to transform into military systems, and that, you know, put stuff together, build weapon systems, resupply, transport it, move it, keep people fed.
Lou, have you heard of this new laser weapon system that Israel's supposedly getting?
Yeah.
Does that work in bad weather?
Iron beam?
Yeah.
Well, Greg, the Navy tested our version of that on a destroyer. I think it's the Helios system about 5 months ago. So we've got operational lasers that can shoot down now. Are they as effective as iron beams going to be?
Maybe. Are these lasers for shooting stuff down, or just for totally screwing up the communication or wherever you're shooting at?
Well, both.
Okay.
The system that was deployed on the Navy destroyer was designed to take down, you know, incoming stuff at relatively low speeds, you know, like subsonic speeds. So that would include any kind of slow moving drone or whatever. And obviously,
well, I mean, is it like supposedly cause damage? Does it take a wing off, or just blow up the communication?
It burns through whatever
okay.
part of the drone it hits. It can cut a wing off. It can blind it. If it hits it, it takes it down.
Supposedly, the cost per shot goes from like, you know, a $50,000 missile down to like $3 worth of energy.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. And it can fire as long as the capacitors are charged, it can fire, you know, 50, 100 shots. Each laser or each capacitor can fire 50 or 100 shots. So the question with Iron Beam, and I'm curious about this, the issue with lasers is propagation. You firing through the atmosphere takes a lot of energy, and the beam tends to disperse. So the question is, for me, is what is the intercept range? You know, how far out are they reaching with this thing? And because are they going to be able to reach as far out as they can with Iron Dome? I don't know. That'll be interesting. And is it going to be, you know, effective against, you know, artillery shells, for example? They can shoot those down, or rock, you know, heavy rocket warheads that are fired in there. Is it going to be able to take those down? That's going to be really, really interesting. By the way, I'll make another note. The Navy published a video yesterday, I think, of an F-18 intercept on a drone, a Shahed, or one of the slow moving drones launched by our friends the Houthis, who just, you know, don't seem to get the message, but maybe they will eventually. Anyway, using a relatively inexpensive unguided rocket that we've now figured out some way to make smart and guide it, and so you're shooting at a $10,000 drone with maybe a $15,000 missile, as opposed to something like a Sidewinder, which costs, I think, now $150,000 or $200,000 a shot. And so our defense systems are starting to move in the direction, as we discussed earlier, move in the direction of cheap, reliable air defense against these, you know, kinds of swarm systems. And a laser, honestly, is the way to do it, because if you have a swarm, if you have 50 or 100 drones launched at a single ship, your air defense systems are not going to be able to overtake something like that reliably, but a laser could.
Well, all you have to do is watch Star Trek. The phasers would have done a great job. You wouldn't use a photon torpedo on a drone.
So, well, you know, I'm not really a Trekkie, although I did like the series. What is the difference between the phaser, which fires energy beams, apparently at unlimited distances,
where you can narrow beam, wide beam,
and a photon torpedo?
Photon torpedo, you actually had to load them. They were like regular torpedo. They were when they hit, they blew up. They were like,
I used to watch. I watched that in the movie the first time I saw them. You know, pulling the racks off and sliding those things in, and I thought, oh come on, we haven't figured out how to manually or how to automatically put those things into stores so that they just have to push a
button.
They
had to look like they were a torpedo. What the heck? But evidently they blew up when they got close or did something. They were like a torpedo or the phaser with the whole, you know, you saw the whole way.
So I was reading one of the old Triplanetary series. So if you haven't read Triplanet, if you're not a science fiction aficionado, you probably don't know this, but Triplanetary was one of the first series of space operas. It was tremendously popular. It had a pulp, published in a pulp, science fiction pulp magazines, I think written in the 30s. The dialogue certainly is from the 30s. But they talk about a weapon that I thought was like genius, and I thought, you know, this is the way you do it. So the bad guys are coming at this planet that the good guys have, and the good guys put a series of synchronous orbit satellites, very powerful satellites, in orbit around the sun of this, the star of this friendly planet, and it's such that they are able to literally compress, like a magnifying glass, compress the radiance of the sun, of the star, into a beam that's, you know, I don't know, 100 miles wide, but they effectively take, you know, the energy of have a hemisphere of the star that's radiating and direct it away from all the other places it's going in terms of radiating outward, and then focus it into this.
Sort of like lighting a campfire with a magnifying glass.
That's exactly what it is. It's just a super magnifying glass. But the energy that they're focusing is so monstrous that nothing can withstand it. But it's hard to aim. So they basically force the bad guys into this, who don't know about the weapon, force them into this area, and then they sweep it with this beam that is, you know, effectively a giant magnifying glass, and it just wipes everything out.
You know, there's such thing as that in real life. LQG.
No.
It's I think the largest quasar or whatever. It's that beam is like billions of light years long.
Oh yeah. Well, the gamma ray burst. A gamma ray burst is a focused. Yeah, right. And that, you know, a gamma ray burst is effective. What? 200, 300 light years, at least.
That's a ways.
I do know, and I was trying to remember where I read this, but it was, you know, some kind of serious ways to die in cosmic accidents. But if one of our stars within like 200 or 300 light years of us goes nova, and focuses this in the process of nova, emits one of these gamma ray bursts. If we're in the path of it, it would exterminate all life on one side of the planet within, I think, a matter of minutes.
Lou, if you look at all this stuff going out, if we don't mess ourselves up here, which we're probably on our way to doing, you know, there's either going to be an asteroid here or gamma rays or something's going to get us.
Well, I, again, you know, space is big and there's lots of stuff happening, but that. I when I read about the, you know, these things, and we've detected them at great distances, but yeah, if we're unlucky enough to be in the pathway of one of these things, it's devastating. It would probably be the end of life on the planet, but it definitely would kill. I mean, I remember reading.
Would it kill the cockroaches?
It would kill everything. It would be the functional equivalent of being near a neutron bomb. That was set off, where you just become instantly irradiated. But it would, the people on the other side of the planet would probably be safe. Whoever happened to be on the exposed side would be, you know, would die very quickly. It's crazy.
What a great show. We're all dead.
What other pleasant things?
I still like the old Flash Gordon. Even when you were back in those days, did anybody believe the spaceship that went down like the track, and then the track pointed upward like a ski slope, and the thing just kept going up into space? I still think that was the corniest thing I think I ever saw.
But that launch, that ski slope launch, was projected by a number of science fiction authors who had actually, like Arthur C. Clarke, who had actually done the math, and it Heinlein wrote a whole series about this. But the launch. The launch mechanism went up Pike's Peak. He wrote this at or around the time they were establishing the Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs. So he put the launch system in Colorado Springs. So it was like this, I don't know, 30-mile, or no, not that long, 10-mile track, started in Colorado Springs and then ran up the side of Pike's Peak, and they would launch the rocket, and then it would shoot up.
Why talk about a stupid question? How did Air Force Academy end up in Colorado Springs? I mean, you'd think that a lot of other people would have wanted it near them.
Oh no, there was a lot of upset. In fact, one of the places, Tom, that they looked was Lake Geneva.
Really?
They were looking at, because they were looking for locations, and that was one. Some states had campaigned for it. But I always remember thinking, you know, if we'd gotten Lake Geneva, we would have been near the Playboy Club when I was a cadet, which would have
Did you ever stay at
greatly
that place?
Enhanced my college experience.
Did you ever stay at that place?
I'm sorry?
Did you ever stay at that place?
No, hell no.
On a golf outing after it was no longer the Playboy Club.
Okay. Well, I know. I've never stayed there. I typically didn't have that kind of cash.
Well, it had some really interesting things about it, but the place was an absolute piece of crap. If somebody walked down the hallway, like, your bed shook. Plus, they had so much asbestos. They went through how many owners before somebody finally said, "I'll keep it," and they had to put a big bubble over the thing. But it had two really nice golf courses. It had a landing strip, nice pools, and what else did it have? A ski slope. So it had like everything except the resort itself. You couldn't even tear it down because of the asbestos. It was so screwed up. But it couldn't have been built with plywood, Lou. I mean, literally, I'm sitting there. You know, this is back when you were younger, you could sleep through anything. All of a sudden, I'm like, "What the hell is all this shaking?" All of a sudden, somebody walked down the hall. The thing had been gone up with a lick of a promise. I mean, whoever built it, but the airstrip was real nice. The two golf courses are gorgeous. I mean, everything else was really nice, except the place itself was horrible.
Except the actual habitation. Yeah. Well, I guess they were counting on you being distracted while you were in your room.
Tell you what, you played at one golf course, you're distracted. You're in a sand trap the whole time.
Anyway, the academy was the site for the academy, and to a certain extent, this was a little bit of a mistake because they should have put the place closer to Washington, but like Navy or Army.
That's what I was thinking. I would never have guessed that's where it ended up.
But at the time, the Air Force was brand new. They were getting their academy. They didn't want to be near Army or Navy, and they wanted. There were a number of places. They looked in the Midwest, but they picked Colorado Springs because of the weather and potential for flying operations. It's a gorgeous. The campus is gorgeous, and it, there was a where they put it at the time. There was a ton of room. They could get 18,000 acres cheaply. They could condemn it. They weren't going to be interfering with, a big local city operation with the airstrip, and so that's where it ended up.
But then people like Ed Rantoul and the bases here in the Midwest make a. I got to believe the place in California must have wanted it.
Nobody in California wanted it.
Really?
There was a place in Illinois. Well, Lake Geneva was looked at. There were like three final places, and then they announced it was going to be Colorado Springs. But there was a huge military presence in Colorado Springs as well, and they moved before they finished building it. They announced the site. They put up a temporary academy at Lowry Air Force Base here in Denver, and ran the academy there for I think 2.5 years, and then they moved the entire cadet wing and operation down to the academy in 1958, I believe. First class graduated in 59.
Is there going to be a space academy?
I'm sure that some bureaucrat in Washington D.C. is lobbying for that right now.
Is there a big
like
base
you're being
up
a little
in
elitist there?
Wow. Is there some big base up in Syracuse? And my cousin came out of University of Colorado, and he was an Air Force ROTC. He was based there for a long time in upstate New York, and they would fly up to way up to Canada, and then look for Russians and stuff, and fly back. Was there a big base there?
There was a large base in upstate New York, and then Syracuse is where the Air National Guard is for New York. So there's a big Air Force operation up there. I can't remember the name of the base right now in New York. Upstate New York had Air Force activity. I mean, those bases, Tom, as you know, were of a tremendous economic boom to the local areas.
Well, that's what, I sure as hell don't want to get involved in politics, but some of these blue states versus red states, if you look at a lot of the red state people are all over small government and crap. Some of those states get an incredible amount of money from the federal government for bases and stuff vis-a-vis the blue states.
Oh, yeah.
It's not even close.
Yeah.
You know, how much Alabama and Mississippi and those kinds of places. The state that gets the absolute... of course, I can't find it. If I could ask Greg to find it, he probably would be able to. There's the state that gets the most from the federal government. You probably can name it, but this was a pretty interesting study because it took... It was like seven or eight things. Maybe it was five or six, Lou and Greg. It wasn't only like bases and people who worked there was how many people kind of retired there, how many, all kinds of stuff that were all kinds of federal money. So if somebody, if you worked at a base forever, probably you retired there. It was how many people on federal employment. But New Mexico stands out like no tomorrow compared to any other state in terms of people that are getting federal retirement there that used to be in the Army, veterans assistance, you know, bases themselves. But California is the place when, how many years ago, Lou, when they closed, California used to have all kinds of bases, and they closed almost all of them.
They closed a lot of them, yeah.
There was one in Oakland. It was Oakland had a big air base, and I don't know if it was Navy.
Well, yeah, the Miramar, the Marines have that huge operation down in the southern part of the state.
Are you talking, do you want me to find nominal or per capita?
Well, but I'm saying this particular study counted about five things. Normally, there was like something like 8 or 10% of the people in New Mexico are on a federal payroll one way or another. Where with some states, like Illinois, is like half a one or something.
I think that's probably right, given that you don't have a tremendous amount of native industry and industrial base in New Mexico, but you have a huge federal presence in New Mexico.
Yeah. Sports trivia for you, Lou. We'll only spend a second on this one, but here's one that no one would get. I couldn't believe. What cities have had a championship in all four of the major NBA, Major League Baseball, football, and hockey? There's one here you'll never, ever get. But the ones are the obvious ones. I mean, you got New York, you got Chicago, you got Boston, by the way, is the only one that has won all four in the 21st century to date.
Yeah. Kansas City doesn't have an NBA franchise.
Right, so they're out.
Can we count Milwaukee with the Packers?
They don't have a hockey team that won.
No, they don't. That's right.
Miami's the most recent. The Panthers won last year.
Yeah. Yeah.
But here's one you will never, ever get. And I'll just give it to you. I don't want to say more time. St. Louis.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
The Rams won a Super Bowl while they were there.
The Rams won a Super Bowl, yep.
And guess who? The NBA St. Louis Hawks won in 1958. I was not
counting them for the basketball. That's interesting.
But did they go from there to Atlanta? They must have.
Quick sports issue. Who do you like for the tourney?
Anybody but Auburn.
Okay.
I think your Duke guys might surprise.
If this flag kid is full speed, I would be betting on them.
What was his injury?
Badly sprained ankle.
Oh, that can last a while.
Yeah, yeah. And so I don't even think they'll play him in the first game. Try to give him as much rest as possible. He is. Although I will say this, I mean they beat North, and you know the controversy over whether North Carolina belongs there or not. You know my impression, and I am not a Tar Heel fan, but they passed the eye test. Number one, they had a terrible start to their season. They were coming on very strong at the end, although Duke beat them without their two starters, and it was a close game, but they got them. But without Flag, Duke is a very good team. With Flag, they are I think a potentially great team, and
Injury going to keep him from the NBA or no?
No, I don't know. I'd love to see him come back for another year because I think he would do nothing but get better. But I don't see how he turns down that NBA payday.
Well, how much is Duke paying him?
I don't know. Duke's got a good NIL program, but I don't know. I haven't seen the details of that contract. But he's apparently really likes college and is carrying a high 3 GPA.
4.8 million.
4.8 mil.
Yeah.
Yeah. So,
Lou, what is if you know to go back?
You're saying
to your,
it's enough that he might stay for another year.
Well, the issue is every year I'll use the term waste in college, keeps you a year away from the NBA max contract, right?
Yes.
That's the drill.
That's the math.
Yeah, that's the math on it, which is kind of screwed up. But Lou, if you had to estimate, because you have your agent history behind you, if you hire like a new coach in Indiana, which I just did, we're talking about that with Russell yesterday, because he's teaching down there. Now you hire this guy, the skill set. I find a huge bifurcation between the guy who is the coach, the you know, if there's such a thing as a normal coach, and somebody who runs the quote NIL department. And I was just wondering if all of a sudden you give you and me and Greg that job, all of a sudden we see, oh, there's 400 names in this pipeline. We need a few guys, like everybody does. How the hell do you even get...
Sounds like a logistics problem.
Well, but I mean, how do you even get game films of these people if they haven't played? You're not going to get any practice
Sounds
films.
Like a logistics problem.
And everybody's going to want some money. How do you run through those amounts of names and figure out who the hell you want?
There are algorithms that could probably do that if you can get stats on the kid. Invariably, anybody that you're looking at getting from the transfer portal, you've already looked at as a high school player.
Right, and, so that there's 20 of them instead of there's 300 left.
I don't know how you would manage those numbers except maybe through the use of some algorithm, but typically what these coaches have done and their departments have done is focused in on, okay, we have specific needs for a particular skill set, you know, a forward for basketball, a forward, a guard, you know, a shooter, somebody who can rebound or shot block, and that's what we're going to go after, and so the field narrows dramatically there. They obviously have a list of how many kids are in the portal, and they know, for example, okay, we scouted the following guys in the portal, and we didn't like them, or they're not going to match up for these particular needs, and so that's how you.
But in high school, the coach, anything you want, I have to assume part of the attraction to going to a certain high school, unless you have to go there, is that guy's going to promote you. He's going to say, yeah, I'll give you all the practice film of this guy, and I'll give you all the game film. I mean Notre Dame's not going to give you the practice film of some guy who's never played tackle and as a sophomore wants to leave. How do you know if he's any good?
You would bring him in. You would look at his development. You would talk to people who knew him. There are ways to get information.
It just seems to me, what size of a staff would this be? Plus, the guy's not just going to show up for free. He goes, I want 500. How do you know what to pay him if he's never done anything but practice?
Yeah, these are all legitimate questions. This is all going to have to be sorted out as part of that NIL deal that's going to get approved next month.
Because Kevin says that they've been hiring actual general managers, but even that means he's got to hire a third guy, so he can supervise that guy plus the coach.
If they've done the smart thing and dumped their entire DEI departments, they'll have excess positions that they can put into their athletic team.
Well, yeah, but I don't know that it's. Well, Kevin always talks about you look at the budgets of these athletic departments. This will end someday, Lou. Everything does. But he says that, there's like the, whatever.
Or it'll get bigger.
Well, the person who's the publicist for like the lacrosse team. I mean, how many people do you need in an athletic department in the school, for God's sake? I mean, what are they all there for? I mean, you just wonder what at some point what part of education does that become?
Yeah.
Like the made-up studies programs at UNC.
I think the solution on a lot of this, and Kevin talks about it, and so does Russell as well, about how when you look at how much the interplay is between people going from in some states, these junior colleges or whatever you want to call them, and floating into the Purdue's at a junior year, so you save those couple of years of tuition and these are people that a lot of them are living at home. I mean, we're talking about going to the other end of the spectrum, and you wonder how does hiring a boatload of people to promote the lacrosse team essentially fits into that. I mean, you do have to wonder, right? Who cares about the lacrosse team or the swimming team, or for that matter, the football team? Or the, you know, I guess they make money, but nobody else does. It just seems, how this all shakes out is a very fascinating economic thing for me to watch, Lou. I just love watching it and talking about it.
Well, there's a gazillion permutations here that are going to start running out, and in terms of how this is going to develop as a business. But and we've been talking about this for a decade. It's quite clear that we are moving toward an NFL type salary cap business model with these NIL groups, and it's going to, and you know, as I said months ago, if I'm a college athletic director, I'm looking at this going, I did not sign up for this kind of a requirement. Is there any way I can outsource this? And here comes your BlackRock or whatever investment group comes in to save you, saying, we will take all of this off your hands if you will join our 70-team Super League to play college football. And we'll take care of all of this.
Well, and my
it has a lot of attraction.
A lot of people will go toward the high end, which you just did. Okay, you're saying there's so much money in this piece of it that essentially the tuition, the students, the guy who just wants the education, which we seem to be falling down on in this country a little bit. Guy who just wants the bare bones education, doesn't want to pay $75,000, whatever the hell it is, but wants to learn something so he can get a job, for God's sake. Why, when you start using profit as a motive, and you say, okay, we're going to do everything we can to make money on football, maybe basketball, maybe a few schools, some baseball, maybe some women's basketball, all the other places. Why do I give a flying bleep about the fencing team? And why do I have five people on scholarship on the fencing team?
Why do I care about women's basketball?
Well, someplace they make some dough.
They might make some money there, but why do I care about any women's sport?
Well, yeah, that's what I'm saying. I mean, I think women's basketball will end up making enough for themselves.
It hasn't yet.
I'll bet it's at least a break even at Notre Dame.
Yeah. That's not the rule in most places. As you know, it's not the rule in most places.
No. Well, most places, the football doesn't make money.
Well, but to the extent that there is money to be made, it's football that brings it in.
Yeah, well, if your conference is 14 teams in the NCAA, there's a lot of money there.
And don't discount the donor impact of a good football program, a successful football program or basketball program.
But there's other places that would counter that. You know, Chicago doesn't have a football team of any
kind. No, but I mean, I'm just saying, if you're right, once the economic factor comes in on this, it changes everything.
Yeah,
it changes the whole orientation of the program.
Well, the Irish, just take their basketball team for instance. They pretty much sucked. They got one good ball player. Now a bunch of these guys graduated, and the coach makes, you know, $2.5-3 million a year. They sucked. Now, at some point, somebody's going to cost them, you know, $30,000 to recruit somebody, at least. Well, you know, I don't know that, but I'm saying, the coach comes out to visit you, his fat ass is not going to be in Southwest Airlines. It's going to be in a private jet, right, the way this is going. So he flies out to see, sees your parents. You fly the kid in for maybe the kid's coming in commercial, but I doubt it. He's a big star. He's coming in a private jet. For God's sake, when the guy said, the local watering hole said, Miami of Ohio took somebody's mother down there on a private jet to see the campus, to talk to the kid and to go in there. I mean, this is let's put it, say it's, I'm not going to say it's out of control, but it's okay. It's $30,000 to $40,000 per kid to recruit, because you recruit a lot of kids, you don't get them, right? So the four you get, what do you suppose the whole tab is there, Luke? A couple hundred grand? Easy, for maybe more than that. So you get these guys, and maybe they work out, maybe they don't. You're paying a coach X number, and all of a sudden they don't win. Hey, why do I have to keep giving you $75,000 a year in tuition? Plus, God help you, you got to get some NIL money, or you won't be here. So I'm giving you $200,000 a year. It cost me $50,000 to get here. And by the way, you suck. I mean, we're not. Somewhere along the line, somebody's going to say, "What exactly did the Notre Dame basketball program pay $10 million for?" Or somebody else.
Yep.
I mean, it works both ways.
Yeah, I mean, we become much more. The intangibles that we used to talk about supported our athletic programs are going to rapidly disappear.
Yeah, I think
people pay a lot for hedge funds; they don't get anything.
Well, you're supposed to.
I don't know.
But you don't even get hedged,
right?
You don't even. The best I heard, there was a guy. I don't know if he's still alive. You ever hear of C&D commodities? Rich Dennis. He was a big name for a long time, and he started a hedge fund. Now, the interesting part, and like if I were to start throwing track records out there, which I can't really do because I do stuff individually for people, so you can't. I don't have a common fund that I can say this is the square hole that I put every round peg in, like most of these places. Okay, so I don't do that. So I could be very successful for you in terms of what you have, you might have legacy stock, you might have all this kinds of stuff, but it's not a track record that I could say, well, geez, last year I bought 90% NVIDIA and I'm up 25%. I can't do that because I don't have commingled funds. Anyway, but if I were to do that, I have to publish everything I do. I can't have a silver fund, a gold fund, and something else, and only publish the one that made money. I mean, I could have a long silver fund and a short gold fund. All of a sudden, everything rallies to the moon. Now, on the future side of the world, I can publish whatever fund I want. I don't have to publish the whole portfolio, which is kind of weird. But on the security side, you have to publish every return you have, right, Greg? Which is hard to do. And especially if you got people with different stuff in their accounts. Matter of fact, it's impossible if that's what you're doing. But this guy, Rich Dennis, opened up a hedge fund. Actually, it's a commodity pool, which is sort of the same thing. And he lost like 30% of the dough in like 2 months. And he closed it. And everybody said, so he opened up another one. The thing was funded within like 4 hours. He could never screw up twice in a row. People couldn't wait to put the dough in the next fund. Though.
See? Same thing.
We'll get a new fund. Hell with that fund. That one didn't work out. We got a new one.
I don't think Duke will ever have any problem raising money.
No. Well, Irish probably as well.
Right.
But you know, the biggest ones are who's got the most? Lou, is it Texas A&M? Or other than the Ivy Leagues?
In terms of NIL endowments?
Well, I mean, A&M has got massive amounts of money. Is that oil money?
Yeah. I still think Harvard is number one.
Oh, yeah. I'm saying the Ivy Leagues are kind of in a class by themselves, but they've been doing it for how many hundred years?
Yeah. And yeah, one of the things I was kind of hoping would come out of this administration was funding bill was raising the taxes on the endowments to regular investment taxes. Guys, I got
to
run.
All right, take care, bud. Good to see you. Last week you were tired. This week you were your old self.
I'm awake anyway.
Well, there you go. S&P futures down 19. NASDAQ down 20. We go for a very small break. We'll be back, Mr. Wayne Manson.
Jocks. Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here. Right now. Right here. Right now. Right now.
Low and opaque stocks and jocks. I'm talking about Greg Pappas on the board. Real quick here because we'll do our regular break at the end of the half hour. S&P futures are down 18. They were down like 35, so we're coming back some. NASDAQ futures down 95, and they were down like $1.50. We were up last night after having a pretty reasonable day yesterday after the Fed announcement, and then I, of course, have to listen to all the people on TV giving their gushing praise for the guy and all kinds of other stuff, and I don't know, Greg, do we have Wayne?
No, not yet.
He'll pile in. I don't know, Greg, as you know, I have this kind of singular look on monetary policy because I'm a monetarist. That's how I was trained under people. That's what they thought, University of Chicago. And I don't think any of that is obsolete, even though people say it is. It's never obsolete. I mean, and what I heard the guy say yesterday was, and you know, critique me. I heard him say, we're going to continue to put money in the market to the point where we're going to lower rates a couple times, but we're going to slow up the runoff from the balance sheet, which means we're not going to absorb as much money out of the system with that as we were, which, and we're going to go back to this transitory number on this inflation, kind of blame it on the tariffs, but we're going to accept 2.6, 2.7, maybe even 3, and we're sort of okay with that, which immediately tells everybody that there's going to be money being pumped into the system, which doesn't surprise me, because that's what they're doing in Europe. I mean, they're going to start printing money to do some of this defense spending and other stuff. I mean, Germany pretty much announced it last week. Oh, by the way, and China did too, although I'm not so sure they have the ability to do it. So what we're seeing is it's sort of orchestrated. We're going to make sure that asset prices stay where they are. And when he talks about, you know, I mean, it's so aggravating. I go back and forth, Greg, and, you know, your opinion's always good.
Well, how much are they going to print would be my question.
Well, if they're going to be at about a 5% a year increase.
All right.
That's where they've been for a while, 4.5, 5, which is a lot.
The markets didn't really move.
Yeah, and I mean, that's been the drill, really, surely since 2007, 2008, maybe even 2000.
So we can be 25% higher in 5 years?
You mean the money supply? Sure.
I'm talking about...
Well, the stocks will go through you pump up asset prices. And what... And the disconnect here, and I don't know... I happen to think, you know, if Paul was here, I'd probably love talking to the guy. But he either is the dumbest guy ever in that spot, or the smartest, and I can't figure out which.
Well, what's he going to say?
When they talk in mirrors, it's like ships passing in the night. When he talks about people who are concerned about inflation and how many people, he said that yesterday, how many people in society are having problems essentially with higher prices. And then he lapses into the inflation rate right now, whether it's 2 or 2.6. Now, you and I know, I mean, I know for sure, I think you know, that he just changed subject on you. Why did I just say that? He just changed the subject without 99% of the people knowing he did. And what in God's name am I talking about? Do you have any idea?
I mean, are you talking about the rate of change versus the nominal change?
The rate of change versus the bubble that's been sitting there for 4 years that people are gagging at. He immediately turns into, we're going to try and keep inflation going forward being this 2.7, our goal is 2, and he goes into this massive mumbo-jumbo, and people look at 2 or 2.7 and they go, well, that's not so bad. But he's forgetting about the 40% that's happened in the last few years. That's what's gagging people. I mean, right now, if a price of a car only goes up 2.5% a year, well, that's not helping anybody.
His problem right now is that the government is going to fund whatever spending continuing resolution, and they got to pay for it.
They're also they want to be able to spend. I mean, Trump doesn't want to raise any of these taxes.
Right. So I mean, that's his problem. He doesn't care about the people.
Well, right. I mean, I'm saying, right, but the two-step that's going here, the way this is done, I'll try and be simple with this until Wayne shows up, is, for instance, the way the CPI is done, it's the rate of change. Okay, so if you have a basket, all right, and wherever the basket is, and the basket's pumping along at 2% a year, all of a sudden something comes flying in, and for some reason, a few things in the basket just like triple or quadruple, which is essentially what happened during COVID, right? And now the weighting, even simpler, all of a sudden your municipality says it's now going to cost you $500 to park out in front of the house, and you go, holy bleep, Batman, where'd that come from? $500 a year. Well, first of all, it wasn't even in the CPI to start with, so it doesn't count, right? But now it's in the basket. Well, now the next year, if it stays at $500, it shows no inflation. So if you have a big jump like we had, and somehow you decide not to count it, or you You say medical stuff over a period of 10 years, say, doubled or tripled, and you foolishly have medical stuff as 0.6% of your basket, or 6% of your basket, not 0.6, and you don't move it up. You essentially are lying to people about how it's affecting them. But now all of a sudden, hey, well, where's the inflation? It's only 2% going forward. Yeah, but what about...
I mean, that's their job.
Well, what, to lie to us?
Yeah.
Okay, I mean, that's one way, that's a somewhat cynical way of looking at it, but it's...
Well, how else are we going to spend more than what's coming in?
But I'm saying he talks about people being wounded. They're wounded because of what has happened in the past. They're wounded from the car going from 25 to 50. And then he immediately changed the subject and says, okay, but don't worry about it. Going forward, the 50 is only going to grow 2% a year. We're already worried about it. It's two totally separate subjects.
Probably in their eyes, they say, well, you're welcome for not... You're getting fired from your job or something.
Well, okay, but I'm saying, and then when he talks about recession, who are we talking about? Are we talking about if you pump extra money into the system every year like they're doing, you're probably never going to have a recession if you lie on your PCE deflator. Why would you? You're always going to have a nominal growth of 5%, and you're going to say, oh, well, the inflation's only one. Well, that shows you're growing 4%, but are you really? If the inflation's really 5%, you're not growing at all, right?
In terms of real,
yeah,
real, you either keep pace or fall behind even more.
Yeah, I mean, so if you look at the average person versus, I've always been one of these guys that everything adds up. I want to know if Greg Pappas and 15 other people, if they all got a raise, and the raise is more than the price of stuff, I'm going to say, if I add all those numbers up, I'm going to show that the economy is doing pretty damn good for my people. If I don't, if I look at just the number up top and I throw some money in the system and the market goes up, all of a sudden I'm getting a different number, aren't I? A different view of the world, correct? One's a look down, one's a look up.
When they're looking, I mean, they're looking to supposedly control inflation, and what was the other one? The dual mandate is,
yeah, well, I think he has a third mandate. One is keep asset prices up.
So right. So inflation, unemployment, and asset prices.
Well, they're not going to admit to that one.
Well, I mean, what they do is kind of just enough to keep everybody from declaring war on each other.
Yeah.
And
well, they think they're doing that, but maybe people already are.
Yeah, maybe we are, but I don't think it's a secret that a lot of traders don't really pay attention to the numbers besides what everybody else is expecting rather than the actual contents of the inputs or the actual accuracy and precision of the data. It's so spotty that I think, at least the traders I know, we know that the data's coming out. We know what the expectation is. We want to know what the surprise is to other people more so than if it's accurate or not.
Well, you want to know the piece that they can't BS over. If they BS too much, then the
market calls shenanigans,
yeah,
on what they're doing,
yeah,
and then it turns. And you expect to be able to see that with what happens in the 10-year rate. So if what they're saying is we're going to maintain interest rates and the 10-year rate is going up, you know, that means we've got a disconnect, and ultimately that's probably negative for common equities.
Well, if he were to say, if he were to come out and say, boy, this inflation, even the CPI inflation, which he's not going to criticize, if even the CPI inflation is still showing 2.7, it's a long way from 2. If he were to say, well, it looks like what we've done so far is not enough, so we're gonna restrict money supply, and oh, by the way, we're gonna raise interest rates even more because we're really serious about this inflation piece. He knows that that's gonna cause the market, at least in the short run, to run down. There's no way he's gonna do this normally anyway, but certainly not with this White House, right? Because all of a sudden it's gonna
come
back.
He would instantly be blamed for,
yeah, sure,
that, and that would be a easy scapegoat for Trump to,
yeah, well, then you can get rid of him and I'll get a new guy, and it'll be
right. He could say that, and he could play the good cop bad cop type of thing. Trump could say, well, I'm trying, but he won't let us do what we want, and that kind of stuff. But in terms of what happens, you need to look at kind of the equity prices and the tenure to see what he's dealing with. I wouldn't put too much stock in much more.
Well, but I'm saying one is a different plan than the other.
The animal spirits kind of affect their or seem to affect their decisions big time.
But he's stuck in a situation where, like I was talking to Russell about yesterday, he's in a situation where a lot of stocks are historically high priced based on revenue times stock price and based on PE. So there's a way to go if he were to do something. We're talking about we're up 20% a year for 2 years. So if he turns the bus around on the amount of money going into the system and actually starts taking some out, which, by the way, would be really interesting because it looks like the European Central Bank is pouring it in. So that would cause a big problem currency-wise too, right?
You know? And you can see the more violent movements happening over the past few months where, you know, the market really is uncertain, and when those currency markets move, that takes a lot more energy to move those than it does the stocks or
bonds. is having if your interest rate in the U.S. goes up 0.25% and it goes down 0.25% in Europe, you're going to find the dollar going higher, right? People are going to scramble to put money over here to get 0.5% interest higher, right?
They're going to put money wherever they think is going to be safest.
Well, not safest. You're going to make more money.
Yeah, you're going to make more money in theory, but you know the Russians had a high interest rate for a while.
But the exchange rate coming back, how do you even get your money
Greece
back?
Greece had a high interest rate for a while. You know, Italy, all those guys, but. Sometimes it just runs away from those places because of essentially what the Fed is doing. But, you know, we still have that card where people still want to come here. People still are literally dying to get in. So you got a big military, you got that. So that's kind of what they're banking on.
Well, all this stuff, the whole message is all this stuff kind of ties together. You can't do just one thing. And now we're in this routine where we poured so much money in that we've got this massive asset bubble. Some people have so much money, I'm not holding against them. A lot of them are my clients. They have so much money they don't want to do it. Now it's a question of protecting it or hanging on to it or hoping them, you know, it doesn't all fall apart, which it probably won't. I mean, I'm surely I don't have people. I have puts, but they're trailing. They're not. They're in case something crazy happens. You know, we're trying to protect people's nest egg. I'm not speculating to the downside here because what the guy said yesterday, they're going to keep putting money in. So even though there might be, now the question is what is the current administration going to do to the Fed if they expand the tax cuts? We just blew through where we started in what end of the fiscal year September, so October, November, December, January, February. We're 5 months in. We've already blown through the $1 trillion number. Well, if you don't get any help from the Fed. Okay, and you start pushing this. Now you're going to have to keep borrowing more and more money. All right. Now, if you do
borrow
that,
more and more at higher interest rates.
The interest rate is going to go up unless the Fed starts buying up the bonds like they did during COVID. In which case, their balance sheet just ends up going on the Fed's balance sheet and just the money they created, which is so bizarre. But now, if you piss off neighbors or people that used to invest here, and you actually did piss them off, I don't know if Trump really has. He pissed them off temporarily, hopefully not forever. I mean, if you piss off the Saudis and the Irish to the point where they're not going to put money here, okay.
Yeah, that's a problem.
That's a problem because, I mean, is everybody here all of a sudden? Maybe we start having good-looking girls running around telling people to buy American bonds like we did during World War II?
That's one way to do it.
Yeah.
You know, you need to have that faith in the institution in order for them to keep putting money here. I'm part of the European... debacle, the EU kind of, I don't know what you call it right now, conflict, that's been a direct benefit to us. I mean, you can see it in the currency movements, you can see it in their disorganization has just funded more of our whatever we want. So the fact that there's still people willing to...
Hey, how about sending Wayne the Zoom link? He says he didn't have it.
He's in.
I'm here.
Oh, you're there. You've zoomed in. You've been
This has been a bad week for me in technology. I need to stop using my old Sports Illustrated swimsuit calendar to figure out what day of the week it is.
Isn't that supposed to be when you retire as a 1%er in Florida? Isn't that the whole idea? Every day's a golf day. It doesn't matter if it's Sunday, Monday, or Tuesday, right?
Yeah. Plus, you know, it's been St. Patrick's week.
Oh, yeah.
You know? We don't have a St. Patrick's Day here. It's the entire week.
Yeah, I'm one of the more of the kind of traditionalists. I just have my beer and corned beef sandwich kind of on the day. Although my brother did cook a corned beef on Sunday that was delicious. I went to the Restaurant Depot and picked out a winner. What was it, what they say, the natural pick me out a winner? I picked out a winner, 20-pound big old corned beef. It was pretty good.
Well, sounds good.
Yeah, it was pretty tasty. Hey, if you can dig back into your repertoire of history, we've got a lot of the right wingers on the show, and I keep mentioning how I don't really like the process that Trump is using and the fact that there's some bloat in government. I guess you can never argue that. And I got the numbers out as you kind of pointed me in the direction of how many people worked during all these different administrations. And two things keep popping up. Is one, are people are convinced that these what's the name for them, the government GM, where they're the hiring essentially of contractors to do the government work through these agencies.
Oh, the outsourcing has been a big deal over the years, yeah.
Is it that much bigger than it was 20 years ago in terms of percentages?
Well, I think COVID quite a bit because...
We're getting like every other word. You got to move to a different spot or something. Are you there?
Oh, I'm here.
Yeah, we're getting like every other word.
Oh, all right. Well, it's not technology is not working so well.
Well, now you're doing all right. So keep going.
I was going to say that telecommuting during COVID really changed the dynamic. I think resulted in a lot more outsourcing to contractors during that time.
So there's some legitimacy to say the stuff on the border. Okay, it's some of the stuff that seems to have been uncovered is there's independent contractors doing a lot of the work, getting paid a lot, with feelers back to individual people in Congress, and a lot of people that are running these places are making like a real lot of dough. I mean, and that's the accusation, and you know what, I'm right with them. I'm agreeing with my right-wing buddies on this. I just wonder how much more egregious it is now than maybe it used to be. Are you there?
I'm here.
Yeah, okay, fire away. So how much, I mean, is it, you know, is it 10 times worse than it was 20 years ago? Is it sort of even? It seems like there always has been subcontractors all over the damn place.
Yeah, what we saw, you know, there's been a couple of reductions in force probably since Reagan in the federal government. The thing that makes this one different than those is those reductions in force were authorized by Congress. Now,
when you say authorized, yeah. Did they pass a bill telling Clinton and Gore to fire people? Or
basically, yes. Yeah,
really?
They put it in a, you know, they put it as a rider in other legislation. But even when Reagan had a reduction in force, that was put into the Reagan budget by his then head of the Office of Management and Budget and his director of Office of Personnel Management. It wasn't very popular at the time, but in all cases except now, where we actually got these DOGE guys, the other day they went to the U.S. Institute of Peace, which is a brand new building on Constitution Avenue, not far from the Kennedy Center, and they walked in there. They're appropriated by Congress, direct funding. It's not part of the federal government, but DOGE team went in there with DC cops, told everybody to leave, and the other day they started prying the name off the building. And you know, this poses a lot of questions. I asked my friend Andy, we're both in the National Press Club, what would prevent the Doge team from going by there and saying, look, National, it has National, it belongs to us, and just walk in and say, hey, you're all fired, we're taking over. And the answer, which I think has been discussed at the National Press Club, is there's really nothing they could do about it.
Well, it seems, Wayne, one thing I've noticed in my last however many years I've been around is a lot of what people sort of thought were rules sort of really aren't. I remember way back when I first started trading, and I got on a couple committees on the board. One of my friends was, he's never ran for office or anything, but he was very tight politically with a lot of people who were in office, right? So we went and had a big long lunch, and he was explaining to me how you didn't really want to be a congressman at a young age because everybody put all their assets with some place they couldn't even touch them. Nobody traded. You only made, at the time, $25,000, $30,000, $40,000 a year. You had to keep two houses, you had a place to live in Washington. It wasn't expensive, it is now. But he said, those guys, he goes, look at the two guys in my area. One guy's name was Italian guy, I'll tell his name, I'll think of it. Actually, they're both Italian guys. And he goes, he's not a member of Beverly Country Club, like all the other people that are his age that are in a good law firm. These are guys in Illinois, and if you remember, we had a constitutional convention. And the entire political class, from Richie Daley to Matt, I think Madigan, all those guys, it was the weirdest thing, Wayne. The Constitutional Convention, anybody who had ever held office could not run for that convention. I can't imagine people voted for that, but they did. And so you had all these new guys that just got out of law school that, they were 30 years old and 32 years old, ran for ConCon. And that's what an entire generation of politicians in Illinois came from, that convention, essentially. So those guys got in there, but he was telling me, these guys, they don't have any dough. And all of a sudden, Cheney gets in there, and he's trading up a storm. And I'm sitting there going, wait a minute. Turns out there was never really a, there might have been a rule. It was more like a convention, but it was never going to be enforced by anybody. And it seems like ever since then, leading up to this, this Trump, whatever it is, nobody pays any attention to any rules, there's nothing there. I mean, one of my attorney guys say, if Supreme Court makes a ruling and they just ignore it, they have zero enforcement power.
Absolutely, and they keep saying, well, we could experience a constitutional crisis. That word alone is kind of ridiculous, because we're already in the territory where they're saying we don't care what federal judges say. We don't care. I mean, I would rather them say, look, we're living in post-constitutional America, which we are. I mean, to walk into a congressionally funded operation, I remember when that building, the U.S. Institute of Peace, was first put up. I was opposed to it because I said it's going to be a nest egg there for a bunch of neocons. It was authorized by Newt Gingrich.
Really?
It was his baby, and I have a funny feeling that those guys, when Trump and his gang went to the Kennedy Center the other, what was it, about a week ago, they passed that U.S. Institute of Peace, and somebody said, hey, what's that? What do they do? And Trump was, hey, you ought to go in there and take it over, because that's a nice building. I mean, it may have been something like that.
But, just in terms of, they just passed his continuing budget resolution, and Trump made a big deal about signing it. Did he just approve the funding for his place they just shut down?
Yeah,
I think he probably did, didn't he?
Yes, and here's the thing: about two buildings away, closer to the White House and Constitution Avenue, is the Federal Reserve. What would stop these people from walking in there and saying, "Hey, look, we're taking over"?
That's probably, well, if the guy ever does what they don't want him to do, I have a feeling that's coming.
I agree with you. I think they're next. I think, unfortunately, the Smithsonian is next, and the reason is they want to rewrite our history. You know, they took down all these web pages for Jackie Robinson and Ira Hayes, who was one of the guys with the Iwo Jima holding up the flag. They took down the pages for all these people because they said they're DEI. They no longer show you where Congressional Medal of Honor winners are buried in Arlington if they're African American, Hispanic, or women, or Native Americans. They removed all information.
Well, I think
from
a lot
websites.
Of people were really against a lot of what was going on with the DEI stuff. Clearly, in Chicago, it's a kind of a disaster, but that doesn't mean we want to go back to the angry white man, do we?
Right, right. And then the worst thing is they got rid of all references to the Navajo code talkers and the Tuskegee Airmen. This is an out-of-control administration. And I think they're...
Who's even thinking up all this stuff?
I think it's Elon Musk. I mean, Musk grew up in apartheid South Africa, and then when it was time for him to register for the draft there to fight for the apartheid army... he leaves. He goes to Canada because that's where his grandparents were from, and then he weasels his way into this country by lying on his immigration citizenship application. But I think him giving that what he called the Roman salute. I think anybody who has ever watched a documentary about the pre-World War II era and World War II of Germany knows that's not a Roman salute. But yeah, we've got this guy Musk. I think he's running the show, and I think Trump is basically the guy at Weekend at Bernie's.
Well, we're going to go to break here. When we come back, if you can, even though they might have had some congressional approval, Clinton and Gore got rid of an awful lot of people. I mean, I'm curious as to how the hell they did that without everybody being as pissed. That being as pissed off as they are today. I mean, SP futures down 20, NASDAQ futures down 91. Be right back, Stocks and Jacks.
This self-directed trading is a lonely job. Online trading is not as easy as point and click.
No, it's not. Everyone, even professionals, need to share ideas and think out loud every now and then.
That's what I like about PTI Pro Direct. Their staff of former option floor traders really helps me choose the right strategy for trading option volatility and plan the time decay for my covered writing program.
Yep, nothing can replace years of trading experience to stop you from making that dumb trade and for saving a few bucks. We've all been there and done that.
Yeah, I have access to all that great trading advice and experience for just a penny a share for stocks, $1 for equity options, and $1 minimum a trade.
Our clients at PTI Pro Direct can call when they need a little help on a trade or just to talk about the market in general. We trade every day. We love this stuff.
That's what I like most about PTI Pro Direct. Cheap prices along with great advice from real floor traders. It's the best of both worlds.
Tell your friends. That's PTIProDirect.com. PTIProDirect.com.
Hear ye, hear ye. The Homer Broadcasting System is on the air.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now. Right here, right now. Right now.
Hello and welcome to Stocks and Jacks. I'm talking about Greg Pappas on the board. SP futures down 21. NASDAQ futures down 100. We've got the March and the June up here. The March will go off the board. I believe it trades today and it'll be off tomorrow morning. But that's more of a great question. Is that true, Greg? It settles tomorrow morning? The S&Ps and the NASDAQ futures?
I don't know. I've been focusing on that. Yes, yes.
I think that is true. Anyway, so we were down more. We were up yesterday just as a review. We had a nice day yesterday. We came back to my computer. I'll do a rant on this one of these days, Greg. But why don't you do? Well, this is going to be slow. Why don't you do some traffic, weather, sports, and I'll get this.
Yeah, it's brutal traffic out there right now. And anybody who didn't notice, we've got small snow accumulations, but it's very slippery. I'd turn back if I were you.
Well, plus we've got the expressway. There was a massive injury pileup on the Eisenhower, and the Kennedy construction started 2 days ago. So
that too.
Could any more stuff be happening? You know, it's impossible for me to get home now, because Franklin is everyone doesn't get out of Kennedy downtown. They want to get off at Ohio. If you get off at Division, they have one of those accident sites there. Well, you can actually get into the accident sites, and now people are using it as an entrance.
Well, one of the good things about having a truck is you can go off-road, right?
Well, we're going to want a sidewalk.
I mean, you got to do what you got to do.
I guess. I just wait in line and whatever. It's only going to be for 9 months. What's the problem?
Yeah. Well, anyways, we've got inbound Kennedy from Montrose, 45 minutes, 68 minutes on the Edens from Lake Cook. That's getting worse, too. Eisenhower from Wolf is 29 minutes. That's not so bad. 32 minutes from 95th to the interchange on the Ryan. And then on the Stevenson right now, this 49 minutes from 294 to the Ryan. So that's not so great. Sports-wise, Bulls lose. That was 121 to 127. Bulls lost at Suns. And then NHL, got nothing from yesterday. MLB, the Dodgers beat the Cubs. That was 6-3. That was in Tokyo, in case anyone missed it. White Sox lose to the Brewers 4-5. And the Rockies lost at the Diamondbacks 0-1. That's all I got, Chief.
I've got the Dax down 350. That's 1.5%. The CAC around down 91.1%. FTSE only down 24. It's 0.3%. So nowhere near is bad on that. Or in Asia, Nikkei down 93.2%. Hang Seng down 551. This thing's been up and down all over the place. But now that's 2.2%. Shanghai down 17.5%. As the Chinese government said they were going to essentially do all kinds of stuff to keep the markets up, and everything didn't work out so well today. Bonds, 10-year down 6 basis points, 4.19. The Bund down 3, 2.75. Japan, or up another point, 1.52. We've got oil, which cannot go anywhere. Still 67.39, up 23 cents, not much. The oil traders can't be doing much. They got to be doing just snoozing over there, Greg. I got to believe. We've got gold up 360, 3044. Silver down 30 cents, 33.90. Copper unchanged, 510. We've got crypto up $9. Slow day there, but 85,373, up from the below 80 did one day last week. Yeah, too much stuff. Wayne, so how? Question. I don't want to get off the topic of how Clinton and Gore managed to do. I seem to recall that they used a lot of attrition. When you got 3 million people working for you, and the average person works there, I'm going to say 15 years maybe, it means you're talking about an awful lot of people that come and go over a year. I mean, if you just held up on some hiring, you can get a long way without really firing anybody, can't you?
Yeah, and I remember the reduction in force with Reagan. A lot of early retirements were granted. I remember people say, "Well, you know, I was going to retire in a couple of years. I got an offer now, and I'm moving out of the Washington D.C. area, obviously to save money."
How does that help? How does that help you? How does that help you money wise?
Pardon?
How does that help you money wise? You're still paying them. You're just not coming to work.
These people got an early retirement, but it was ironclad. They got that in writing from the Office of Personnel Management. Not like what Musk did and said, sent an email offering early retirements. These people that said, okay, they apparently, then they were fired.
Well, I guess what I'm saying is, now they're going to get a retirement check. The only difference is they're not working.
Right, right. Well,
so how does that get you anything?
Yeah, they get a pension, government pension, and they have a something called a thrift savings program. I think they still have that, which is basically a 401k. So,
Wayne, you know better than me. These people, I know it's all done with the little pebble under the shell on the street that the kid shoves around, but it's such BS. There's a lady, person in my family knows this lady, and she was a librarian in a small suburb south of Illinois. Has got way more municipalities than anybody else in the country, but suburbs south of the city, she's a librarian forever. And she's making, getting a raise every year, so she's making a lot more than, quote, a new librarian might make. So they give her early retirement at like 80% of her salary. So I'm not so sure what you gain there, right? just me doing the math. So they hire this new young lady, and first thing she does is get pregnant, right? So when they have, you know, whatever, you get 6 months maternal leave or whatever, you know, it's a generous program. So the other lady, now she's not, the pension does not come out of the suburb, it comes out of the state. So the suburb is saving money on the new lady, correct? But the rest of the people, meaning you and me, we're down on the deal because we're paying the one lady 80% plus we're paying the other lady probably at least 70% of what the first lady was making. So my math has us already down, right? So now the lady gets the maternity leave, and what do you think they do? In your wildest imagination.
They brought back the retired one.
They brought back the retired lady as a consultant. I mean, tell me how this helped anybody.
You know, somebody's got to be in the library to, you know, hush up those kids that are, you know.
So I'm saying, if you do it by attrition, still the people who, well, some people leave for other jobs, so you don't have to worry about them. You're not paying them. But if somebody has, hopefully the person who's 64 knows a little more than the person who's 22, after he's been there 40 years, you would hope. I guess it doesn't always happen. So you shove the guy out a year early. What have you gained? 20% of his salary, and you shoved out somebody good. What is the plus with that?
Well, you know, I think it's the old saying: we pretend to work, and they pretend to pay us. that was an old slogan in the old Soviet Union. But yeah, and some of the jobs, obviously now libraries are being overtaken by, you know, they become more than places to keep books, they're places where you can just get online.
Yeah, oh yeah. And you're getting a lot of books online, and you don't have to lug them home and everything. And it's,
oh yeah, yeah.
Well, that's nice, because, God, I got too many books in my place. I mean, it would have been nice if I just would have gotten them online when I got them. But,
well, that's something you share with myself and Andy in Washington. We all of us are overloaded with books, and unfortunately, I never read these things. I used to get books sent to me by authors. Hey, can you write a review? And I'd say, okay, I'll get around to it. I never had enough time to write the review, but my God, I have these books stacked up.
Well,
I was supposed to read.
I started on the topic before the break, and anyway, the politicians that I knew in this area, and I knew Marty Russo, he was the guy I was talking about. I knew of him, and we talked a couple times. I mean, if I walked down the street, he wouldn't recognize me. But I didn't know Paul Simon, but I, you know, followed him. I was a big fan of his. Actually, when I was real young, I kind of liked Everett Dirksen, Republican. I liked Fitzgerald. He's a Republican. I mean, I liked Adlai Stevenson when I was young. None of those people came home rich. And now one of the issues with, you know, Congress doing their job vis-a-vis Musk, vis-a-vis Trump, I mean, doing whatever Congress is supposed to do, everybody I talk to, young people, and a boy, you know, Greg, I won't speak for him, they think every one of these people is essentially a turd, just out there making money without any regard. And I know that's not true, but boy, the bad apples have surely overwhelmed.
Yeah, they exist. I actually met Paul Simon at a book fair at the National Press Club in Washington, and I stopped and chatted with him, and a week later he died, and I was like, oh my God, I hope it's not that I said.
Well, he came back and was a teacher at the community college.
Yeah, yeah.
But, I mean, Rosty Rostenkowski, he had a six flat over in the Polish neighborhood and walk his dog in the morning by himself.
Yeah, they went after him for what would be like a jaywalking violation today. I mean,
you know what? He was a big Polish dude you couldn't push around.
I remember him. Yeah,
and somebody wanted to push him around, and he didn't give, and they got him out of there. Did Denny Hastert come right after him, or was there somebody in the middle?
Denny Hastert
was a speaker. Rosty was the head of the Ways and Means Committee.
Yeah, yeah. I think Jim Wright came after. Jim Wright was in the early 60s, and then Newt Gingrich became the speaker. And Hastert, after Gingrich resigned in a scandal involving Infidelity or something. They got him on and a book deal. Then we had Hastert. Hastert took his place.
I don't think I've ever seen a guy. We had a meeting with the SIBO, and we had it at the Willard. I'm sure you've been in that place a bunch of times.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it's right across from the press club, as a matter of fact.
Which
yeah.
is right down a block from the White House, right?
Yeah, out a block away, yeah.
Well, for those who don't know, the Willard Hotel's been there, like, it hasn't, I don't know about Trump, but up till a few years ago, every single president who's ever been in Washington has stayed in the Willard at least once or something, right? Or some bizarre, maybe it stopped, you know, in Obama years or something, I don't know. But that's the place that allegedly the term lobbyist, because after, didn't the Civil War, the Southerners wrecked the White House, and then Lincoln stay in the Willard? And
Abraham Lincoln stayed there in the interim between the election and the inauguration, which was in March in those days. I mean, I think they changed, FDR was inaugurated in March. And Lincoln, every time he'd walk through the lobby, you know, there'd be these guys looking for, you know, favors and whatnot, and they would, you know, crowd around him and, you know, want to get his, you know, promises that they would do this and that. And it's really maybe an urban myth that's where the term lobbyist came from. I don't know. It sounds good to me. I've always kind of used that when I'd be giving people tours of Washington. We'd always have, because it's a fantastic lobby in the Willard. Doesn't look anything now like it probably looked like when Lincoln was there. But
they also have the most incredible little bar. It's the Crow's Nest, right?
The Round Robin. It's allegedly it's the same size as the Oval Office. And it's round, like the Oval Office is also round. So.
But there's a window that you can look out, a big window, and see who's coming in.
Right.
So if somebody's coming in and you don't want to talk to them, you can get out of there before they make their way up to the bar. So
that's right. You can get out and hit the elevators and go to your room.
Yeah. So, I'm sitting in there one night, imagine that. And one afternoon, I met some guys from the SEC I was talking to. And sitting next to me is none other than Newt at a table with this couple, this middle-aged couple. I never saw anybody that looked exactly the same in person as he did on TV like that guy.
Yeah.
I mean, he could not disguise himself anywhere. He had that kind of singular look. He looked just like Newt, and there he was, Newt.
Oh, I've run into him on many occasions. Another funny story. Before it was Jim Wright, it was, you know, Tip O'Neill was a speaker. And Tip O'Neill used to go over to the place called the Dubliner, which is across from the Capitol building, Irish pub.
Do you imagine that? Tip O'Neill. Yeah.
And he's the guy. He said, listen, you know, it would save me time every time I got to run back to the Capitol. Can you get C-SPAN on in here? And today they have C-SPAN on a television dedicated just C-SPAN, because that's what Tip O'Neill asked for, so he would know when he actually had to go back to the house, because he would see what they were doing, and if nothing was going on, he'd stay there and keep drinking.
What's the place the other side of the White House? Is it the Hay Adams or something something?
Oh, the Hay Adams. They've got they got one of these sort of, you know, C and B scene bars in the basement of the Hay Adams. Yeah,
I was down there. It was absolutely a riot, but everybody there, the people from the White House are in there, and every TV was C-SPAN. Everybody's staring at it because something happened. Yeah. You had to dash back across the street or something. But I guess the question I'm trying to get to, when all of a sudden did the people who hang in there, matter of fact, I'll branch off again here, Carl, who's our guest on Thursday or Tuesday and Friday, actually helped the guy in Florida, your turf, become a representative. And, you know, he did his financing for him, you know, so he didn't screw up, because he was running against somebody who was popular. So, you know, you got to make sure you do everything right, of course, they'll come after you, right? So Carl handled that for him, and I think he gave him a few bucks. I mean, I never asked him, but anyway, the guy gets in. He goes to one of the orientation things, and they said, well, you have to use our cell phone. Like, in that year, so we kind of know who you're calling or something. He's like, I don't want to do it. Anyway, the dude lasted I'll ask Carl and Mark, two to three terms, and he said, you know, this is a friggin' cesspool, I'm out of here. It seems like there's this big turnover of, I'll use the term, regular people that get in there, they last one or two or three terms, then they either say, the hell with this, this is a cesspool, I'm getting out of here, or somehow they cross a line, and then all of a sudden it seems like they make, not everybody, there's places from little small towns and so forth that I think are still pretty honest, but all of a sudden you get to this point where this money just flows to people, and you know, somebody's wife is on this board, or somebody's person, and a lot of what's going on with the border stuff is some of the money for these people that, you know, they hold the immigrants, they feed the, they do something, sort of like a county jail here in Chicago, and all of a sudden the money can be traced back to some, you know, a relative of somebody in Congress, both right and left, and it seems to be worse than it was. Is it really? I mean, I don't remember Paul Simon's wife being rich. I don't remember Adlai Stevenson's.
No.
When did this all? Is there a decade that you could put your finger on that this all sort of changed? I don't remember Rusty's wife being on five boards or anything like that.
Yeah, I think it's a rather. They used to, the House Ethics and Senate Ethics Committee, for that matter, used to actually do their job and go after people that were making money off of their offices, personal, you know, making personal, building up their private bank accounts and whatnot. But I don't, I would say, I think it was probably during the second term of Clinton, we saw things change in that respect, because although I didn't think the impeachment of Clinton was, I mean, I don't think they had, so what, you know, we know what he was accused of doing.
Yeah.
And when it comes to that in Washington, let he or she who is without sin cast the first stone. But I think there was kind of like, oh well, you know, they're all kind of crooked here, and you know, and then George W. Bush comes in bringing that whole Texas crew with him, and I think it just started, the ethics started to really go haywire.
I mean, if my buddy explained to me that none of these guys can trade, and now my nephew and Greg both follow websites all day long of what the Congress people are trading. Well, how did we get from A to B there?
Yeah, you remember during I think it was Trump's first term, there was a Republican congressman from the Buffalo area in New York who actually was making inside trading deals on his cell phone while he was on the White House grounds. Now he was indicted and had to resign, but I keep wanting to see if he's got a job in this administration.
Well, who's
now.
Who was the senator, the lady senator with the big blonde hair, attractive? That is the wife of the head of what's the outfit that owns the New York Stock Exchange, the old NASDAQ, or the, what's the name of that exchange? They own the New York. She was the richest person in Congress for a while. She was appointed, somebody quit, and she was appointed by the governor and then didn't run, but she was in there.
Oh, I know who you're talking about. She was a senator from Georgia.
Yeah.
Interim. And then she was
there for multi years, even though it was interim.
Kelly Loeffler, I think, is her name.
Well, she came out of the COVID meeting and sold all her stock or something, didn't she?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, this, and now this apparently is going on all the time because.
Well, how did it become okay? I mean, I started this out. My theme was: were these things conventions? Were they gentlemen's agreements? And once somebody stops doing it, then everybody stops doing it. I mean, there obviously can't be a law against it, or you know, somebody might get arrested.
Like you're not supposed to wear a hat in either the Senate or the House. And the other day, this guy Mullen, from Oklahoma, was presiding over the Senate, and he was up there wearing his cowboy hat. Now that's supposedly against the rules of the Senate, but who's going to tell him? And he's the presiding officer of the Senate, and I remember
maybe he had a bad hair day.
I remember talking to the doorman of the House. Believe it or not, that is an actual, you know, title for somebody. That's the person who says when the president comes in for the State of the Union, Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States, everybody starts.
Yeah, what's that? What is he? He's the something of the House. What's his name? He's the Sergeant at Arms of the House or something.
Actually, there's another guy who's Sergeant at Arms. This guy is just he's the doorman. There used to be a guy in that position named Fishbate Miller from Mississippi, and I met him one time, and I wanted to bring up the fact that when Bella Abzug, I don't know if you remember her.
Oh, I do.
Feisty.
She's from New York. Oh, very feisty. Boy, oh, boy.
From New York, and she wore a hat. If you remember that hat she wore.
She always wore a hat.
And she came in there one time with her hat on, and Fishbait Miller said, "Ma'am, you'll have to remove your hat." And this Fishbait tells me, "Man, I heard a bunch of words I never heard in my life."
She was
she cussed him out one side.
She was
down the other.
I use the term, she was a handful. She was a bright lady.
Oh yeah, she did a lot. She did a lot for after Watergate. She put in a lot of legislation for people's personal privacy of their medical records. Remember the Ellsberg psychiatrist had been burglarized. And she did a lot in that respect. So
yeah, she was a boy, but she was a not your usual House person, shall we say?
Yes. I still laugh when Fishbait Miller says he was, being from Mississippi. He said, "I heard words I never heard in my life."
I was a janitor at this one school, and this black lady, she was like an Angela Davis type, real bright. She did a great job as principal. Boy, oh boy, in Catholic school, I never once walked into a class where the teacher wasn't already there. Right, and now in public schools, the teacher starts at 8:30 and they're having coffee till like 8:29. And of course, when you get a bunch of 10-year-olds in a class without the teacher there, what do you suppose is going to happen, right? There's a little bit of mayhem until the teacher shows up. Well, she'd walk into the cafeteria at 8:25, and this is during the Vietnam thing, right? "Would all you Vietnam War dodgers get your ass in class?" These guys would put down their coffee and they'd scuttle in because everybody's afraid of her. "For all you Vietnam War dodgers, get your ass in class." I'm sitting there dying laughing. I'm just a janitor, right? They all come racing in. She's like, "Get in there. These kids are in there. What's the matter with you guys?" She'd chew them all out. Oh my God. But I don't know where we're getting the comments. I think, Wayne, we're not kids anymore. I think these guys have been doing it so long that I don't think a lot of people don't even know what's right and wrong here.
And I think, we used to look at some other countries and call them kleptocracies.
Yeah.
Like everybody's on the take. Everybody's being bribed. Well, I think we're basically in that same category now.
We used to do PTI back in the day. Somehow or another, we did a lot of, I get these attitudes, Wayne, because I've seen a lot of this stuff. And we did a lot of business in Mexico. And because we did seminars, and guys came up here and they option seminars. They were trying to put up an options exchange, right? So we would work with the Options Institute, the CBOE. Well, they actually were all the exchanges would participate in them. And they'd give lectures, and we'd give some trading lectures, and we'd give people floor tours and take them out drinking and whatever else. And it always struck me as, well, some of these guys are way up in government. Yet the stealing money in Mexico from your population is a national sport. and it never really was here, and now I'm wondering if maybe it isn't. I just somehow has passed me by. I a guy came in here when we first started doing the show, and he listens every day, and he comes in, he sits down, and he goes, "Tom, what the hell are you doing this for?" I go, "What do you mean?" He goes, "You're managing money." He says, "You probably got some clients that are pain in the ass. Most of them aren't." I go, "Well, yeah, some always are, but most aren't." I said, "I pretty much like what I'm doing, and I like..." He goes, you know enough people. Get yourself a contract at the jail to wash the sheets or some crap, or serve breakfast. You never have to work a day in your life. Join a country club, work on your golf game, and just, you're not being greedy. The money comes in, and they never kick you out as long as you have, He goes, that's where the dough is. And I could never go to Washington as a representative and all of a sudden, have my brother-in-law, if I had a sister, all of a sudden getting some massive contract somewhere. Well, where do people get the morality that it's okay to do this stuff?
Yeah, and the first thing a congressman does, congressman or congresswoman does, when it, right after they're sworn in, is they're having to meet with people to donate money to their campaigns for their next election. It happens right after they're inaugurated.
Well, but that's not personal money. That's kind of different, right? I mean, yes. How do you get to the, you know, the personal stuff where your wife is on five boards or,
yeah,
I mean, that kind of stuff. How does that, and of course, if you ever tried to pass a law that somebody's wife or husband couldn't have their own job, they had to go over like a fart in church, right? Because, oh man, you're telling the guy's wife she can't get a job. Well, she's only getting the job because you're a congressman. Who's kidding who? I mean, come on. I'm sure there are people that have wives that have four PhDs that would have their own. They would have their own board memberships, even if I wasn't a congressman. But it's few and far between, I would think. Anyway, we'll talk more about this next week. What do you got going this weekend? Anything good, or just the usual golf, one percenter dinners, one after another?
Let me look at my Sports Illustrated swimsuit calendar here. I probably don't have the right date.
Okay. Anyway, have a good weekend. S&P futures down 31. We're back down on kind of lows here. NASDAQ down to 140. We tried to come back up. No, we're not. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jacks.
That's all, folks.